Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Bridgehampton, Long Island, New York, and earned a BS degree in pharmacy from Fordham University and a PhD in medicinal chemistry from the University of Washington. He worked for Dow Chemical for 39 years and was its CEO and chairman for 7 of those years. Since 2006, he's been the founder and president of the Great Lakes Loons baseball team. His name? Bill Stavropoulos, and I'm Jack Krasula. And this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to a modern-day Horatio Alger story, Bill Stavropoulos. Bill, welcome. A real honor to have you.
Nice to be with you, Jack. Always good to talk with you.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad, please?
Yes, sure. Well, my mom and dad came from Greece in a little town called Rigianierica. They were kind of like the rivals, little towns of about 1,500 each in Peloponnese and southern Greece. My father came over as a young man, a teenager, actually. He was 16 years old. He went through Ellis Island. He had, I think the manifest said it had $15 in his pocket and a third grade education, but he had a work ethic, and he wanted to make it in the new world. He worked here for about 10 years, then went back to Greece and for a vacation. 6 months later, he had a bride, my mom, and brought her over here. And they lived in East Hampton, Long Island, New York, where my father had a little luncheonette and ice cream parlor, eatery. And then he just raised the family. I had two brothers and a sister.
Did you ever pay for an ice cream cone in your life?
Never. And my father made the best ice cream on Long Island. He was very proud of that. He was very especially proud of his fresh fruit flavors, fresh strawberries and the strawberry ice cream, fresh peaches and the peach ice cream, and so on and so forth. That there was a magnet to that small towns out in the Hamptons. I grew up in Bridgehampton, as you mentioned earlier. And the Bridgehampton Candy Kitchen, which was an eatery and ice cream parlor, was the center of the town and the center of a lot of activities, and my father was the Lord and Master over the Bridgehampton Candy Kitchen.
Bill, what were your dreams as a kid?
You know, I don't think I had, Jack, any specific dreams of what. I was a baseball nut. I loved to play sports. I grew up with Clyde Yastrzemski, who was my neighbor, who became a Hall of Fame baseball player, so we played baseball all our lives. But I kind of knew that although I was a pretty good ball player, I was never going to be in the caliber of the major league. So I just kind of took one day at a time and tried to do the best I could as I was growing up.
Where did you get your love for science and chemistry?
That was through high school, really, Jack. Had a teacher, Dr. Don Smith, who was a science teacher. And he taught chemistry and physics and math, actually, in this little town. I graduated with 16 colleagues. It was a small high school, and we had a lot of individual attention. It was a public school. I think it still is the smallest public school in the state of New York. So science was one thing I gravitated to, and I loved history also. Those two subjects were my favorite in high school.
And you go to Fordham University.
Yes.
And you studied pharmacy. Why so?
I was reading Parade magazine, you know, that little supplement magazine that comes in the Sunday paper?
Yes, yes.
As a teenager, and it had a feature on pharmacy. And it, one of the things it said in there that struck me, it said, that if you studied pharmacy, you had a lot of options to do, go into different careers once you became a pharmacy, because you studied business, biology, chemistry, etc. And I go, and I always liked options. I always like to keep my options open to be able to choose the one that fit me at that particular time. And I said, well, that's a good major, because I could always fall back on pharmacy. And I, if I didn't like pharmacy, I had the background to go in many other fields of study. So I chose pharmacy, and that's why I chose Fordham University.
You had a B.S. degree in pharmacy from Fordham, as we mentioned, and then you got a Ph.D. in medicinal chemistry from the University of Washington. What's the difference between pharmaceutical chemistry and medicinal chemistry?
They're very similar. It's medicinal chemistry is the modern new name for pharmaceutical chemistry. While I was studying pharmacy in at Fordham University, I had two professors, Dr. Jeremiah Sullivan and Dr. Harry Kalalis, who really took an interest in me and encouraged me to go on for my Ph.D. When I entered Fordham University, I had no intentions of doing that, but they encouraged me. So I applied to a number of schools, University of Michigan, University of Wisconsin, and University of Washington. And I wanted to go out west as a young man. I just wanted to see what it was like to be out west. I grew up in a small town in Long Island, and Dr. Sullivan kept on telling me how great the program was at the University of Washington, studying under Dr. Weitrich. So I said to my mom and dad, I think I want to go out west. I want to go to Seattle to study. And my father's reaction was, all the good schools in New York, why are you going way out there? And my reply to him was, why did you come to America from Greece? And he goes, yep, you got a point. So that was how I got out there.
We're talking to Bill Stavropoulos. When we come back, we're going to ask him how it was he joined Dow Chemical in 1967. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Krasula, and we're with Bill Stavropoulos. Bill, 1967, you joined Dow Chemical Company as a research chemist.
Right.
Pharmaceuticals. How did that happen?
Well, it was very interesting. I was nearing graduation, and at that time, you started putting applications to various companies. And Dow Chemical was interviewing potential employees at the University of Washington. And somehow I didn't see that and didn't put my application in, and I was working in the laboratory on my thesis doing my research, and I get a knock on the door, and it's Ray Rolfe, who turned out later to be a great friend of mine, knocks on the door and comes in, and he says, I noticed you didn't put an application into for job applications at Dow Chemical. Any reason why? And I go, well, I just overlooked it. He says, well, I heard your name battered about by a couple of professors, and I thought I'd come up here and see you and meet you. So we had a nice chat, and he gave me an application, and I filled it out. And a couple months later, I went and interviewed in Indianapolis, which they had just bought a pharmaceutical company, Pittman Moore, and at Midland here to talk to them about a potential job. And I got an offer, and I went to Indianapolis as a research bench chemist. That's how it all happened. Just stumbled into it again.
Paint for us a picture of Dow in 1967.
It's a very good question. They were a basic chemical company and chlorinated solvents, etc., expanding into plastics, and they were aggressively growing, and they wanted to broaden their product line, and they bought a pharmaceutical company, Pittman Moore, in Indianapolis. So they wanted to get bigger in pharmaceuticals. the, and that's where I was hired. And Dow has been a company that leveraged themselves financially in order to grow. And they grow very rapidly. And it was a company, although started in a small Midwest town of Midland, Michigan, had visions of being a global company, and they started expanding globally and expanding in different fields. So it was a pretty aggressive company, and a company with kind of a Midwest values, I would say, you know, humble, modest, get the job done, care for each other. And happy to say that culture still permeates the company today, even though it's a $50 billion company today. When I joined the company, Jack, it was probably $1.5 billion in sales, and today it's 50. When I left the company, it was $40 billion, I think. So it's grown rapidly through the years.
From 1995 to 2000, you were chairman and CEO, and then you came back in 2002 as
right.
CEO. The book, The World is Flat. You had team members from Hong Kong to Germany, Taiwan to Texas, Beijing to Brazil. It was a mini United Nations. What was that like, Bill?
Yeah, it's really, when you come to the corporate headquarters, you're going to hear a lot of funny accents at Dow because it's really an international company. It's a company that derives about 60% or maybe even more of its sales outside the United States today. So that's quite contrast to a local small business that was started over 100 years ago by Herbert H. Dow. The culture, though, of the company, no matter where you go to China, France, Latin America, Canada, Midland, Michigan, you're going to see that same culture permeate the company. They go by a set of values, a set of mission, and everybody's kind of guided by that vision and mission that permeates the company. We call ourselves a growth company, and we like to grow not only our company but our people also. If you look at it, Jack, I was the 10th CEO of the company, and the four previous CEOs of the company were all foreign-born.
Wow.
That's how international we were and are.
We're talking to Bill Stavropoulos. Dow Chemical has given us saran wrap, Ziploc plastic bags, spray and wash, stain stick. Bill, you were with him for 39 years. You start as a chemist. You ultimately become the CEO. It's a modern-day Horatio Alger story. How did you ever do it?
Well, you know, Jack, it's and this is what when I interviewed Dow, one of the things that struck me when I talked to the people is that they never pigeonholed you. They always said how what great opportunities you have and how they evaluate people, and you can move from one technology to another, one position to another. It all depends on your ability and your desire. So when I started off as a bench chemist, I was a bench chemist, you know, trying to synthesize the next miracle drug. And after about 4 or 5 years, I moved into a more administrative role. And then an opportunity came about. They were starting a new business within Dow Chemical Company. It was kind of what we call an entrepreneurial company. And they wanted 5 or 6 people to help start it. And I raised my hand. And I remember all my friends, Jack, saying, don't do that because it's very risky and you'll be forgotten in this big company and it's not mainstream. But I kind of enjoyed the challenge. So 4 or 5 of us started this little company within Dow Chemical. And we progressed along. And what happened after about 3 or 4 years, the market changed, and we were making buggy whips when the world needed cars. And our business failed. But, you know, every one of us who was in that business and built it got better jobs from it. So it was kind of maybe a little bit of a career risk. But from there, I just progressed, and Dow has this wonderful method of evaluating people and giving them, looking at what development they could give each individual employee so that they continue to progress. And I was recognized and started getting more responsibility as the years went by. It was just doing your job, and the next job comes up, and that's the kind of company it is.
We're talking to Bill Stavropoulos, who was the chairman and CEO of Dow Chemical from 1995 to 2000. Then you retire. You tell Linda, honey, we're going to travel. I'm going to do the dishes for you. But in 2002, you go back to Dow as the CEO. Why?
Mm-hmm. Well, economic hard times came upon about 2002, and the company went adrift a little bit. And the board was not satisfied with the direction of the company and how it was being run. And they asked me to come back. And it was really, I'll never forget to get the call. Linda and I had the car packed and were driving the next day to Florida. And we looked at each other, and I said, I gave her a call and I said, honey, this is what happened. She goes, well, I guess we got to unpack the car. She was right there supporting me. And I had to go back, and of course I owe so much. I owe everything to Dow and to this community. So I went back, and fortunately things worked out, and I was able to retire a couple years later.
And Bill, your community, Midland, owes an awful lot to you as well. When you came back to Dow in 2002 to be the CEO again, what was your first message to your tens of thousands of teammates worldwide?
I had a couple of things, Jack. One was, I can't do this myself. Second, we got tremendous capabilities in this company, and I have a firm belief that if we work together, we can overcome almost any obstacle. Those were the three initial messages, and then the fourth message is laying out a game plan to get us back on our feet. And I must tell you, the company responded splendidly. And as I said, I was able in the next couple of years to retire and name a new CEO.
Everybody that meets you says this is one humble leader. In business today, if a leader is humble, won't his or her people and customers take advantage of that leader?
I don't think so. I think people want authenticity. I think some people fall in the trap of assuming the mantle of their position and they become different people. Some people call it CEO-itis, where because you're the CEO, you're always right and never wrong, and people have to treat you different. They treat you differently because of your way you're positioned, not because of your person. Plus, if you know my family, you know my wife, they keep you pretty humble.
So,
keep you real. Keep you authentic.
We're talking to Bill Stavropoulos, and I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Krasula, and we're with Bill Stavropoulos. Bill, you've been all over the world. You've met a lot of famous people, and you met with four different presidents. Which one stood out to you as being the most authentic and the one that impressed you the most?
Yeah, that's a very good question, Jack. I had that privilege. All of them are quite dynamic, very intelligent, but the man that stood out in my mind was George H.W. Bush, and I've met him on several occasions. had the opportunity to be at dinners and lunches and golf with them and conduct some business with them. Talking about humble servant leaders, he was a prime example of that. And I'll just relate a little story that kind of typifies the type of man he was. He was on a presidential trip to Brazil, and the Oscar Novo, who was the president of Dow Brazil at the time, had a 13-year-old daughter. Oscar is a Cuban refugee, came over in 1960 when Fidel Castro and the revolution took over Cuba, and he fled with his family over here. And Dow hired him, and he became president of Dow Brazil. While he was down there, his daughter, Mari, wrote a little note to the president saying how proud she was of him and how proud she was to be an American. And she gave a little history of her dad and how her dad was a great American today and how supportive he is of President Bush in the United States. And somehow he managed to get that into the presidential chain of events, and the president must read it. Oscar gets a call that one evening when I was down there, I think the next day, and said that the call was that the president of the United States would like to talk to Oscar Novo. He goes, he thought there was a joke. And finally, it got connected, and the man said that President Bush would love to meet his daughter who wrote that little note to him. So they made an arrangement the next day, and Oscar took his daughter to the hotel, was escorted to the suite, met the president. The president gave her a couple of gifts and sat and talked to her and told her what a wonderful young woman she was and how proud he was of her for what she said about her family and her country, which typifies the type of the human touch he had and how he affected many people, and big and small, didn't make any difference to President Bush. He was quite the man. He's missed.
Speaking,
we need that today, without getting political, Jack.
Okay. Speaking of a gift, when I came up to Midland a couple weeks ago, you know, and you graciously spent time with me in your office.
Yes.
You gave me a special gift, a book that you wrote for your family. Tell us about that book.
Yes, it's the title of the book is Ephtahes, which is a Greek word that means a person of good fortune. And my story is not a hardship story. I was raised in a loving family who was given lots of opportunities, and this country offered me a lot of opportunities. But I thought it was important for future generations of Stavropoulos to understand where they came from. And talked about my parents and my grandparents and my career and some of my philosophies. And I recorded it, and I did it for my family, so they would have a record so that when they tell their story, they would have this as a foundation. You know, we all regret. I wish I had spent more time talking about my father's past and how he grew up and my mom's past and how they grew up. And sometimes you forget to do that in life, and I regret it. But so I wanted to record it for future generations of Stavropoulos.
Everybody looks up to you for your humility, amongst other things. And in the introduction of your book, you talk about, and I quote, love of honor.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean?
There's a Greek word, love of honor is phleotimo. It's a Greek word, and it literally means love of honor. And what it really means is doing the right thing, and it's something inside us that motivates us to do good, to be good, to honor the family, without regard to any self-interest. And it's something that my mother always used to talk about is philotimo, doing the right thing, being honest, having virtue, working hard, caring for your family, giving back. It's all-encompassing. And it's a word that if you ask probably 10 Greeks, you might get 10 varieties of answer, but it all comes back to honoring your family, honoring yourself, and doing what's right.
The last chapter of the book is entitled Thoughts on Happiness.
Mm-hmm.
And you start out by talking about what's true happiness. What is
it? I talk about, you know, what makes a happy life, and I guess everybody has its own definition of happy, what a happy life or what a good life is or a successful life, and everybody has many definitions of success. And I'm not talking about monetary success here. But I think it's the foundation of a good life, Jack, is commitment, and commitment to four things, I believe, and it's commitment, one, to a set of beliefs and values that are guideposts, that are all the actions and all the decisions you make, whether they're tough, big, small, short-term, long-term, are weighed against those values and beliefs. Are they consistent with them? So that's the first foundation. The second foundation is a commitment to your family, that you provide for your family. Your families go through many ups and downs, but there's always a commitment. You made a commitment, you keep that commitment, and that's your priority. The third priority is to your job or to your vocation. Whatever you choose to do in life, you do it the best you can. And one of the best examples of how everybody can contribute, Jack, have you got time for a little short story?
Yes, sir.
I was touring a food factory, small food factory, with the CEO many years ago. And there was a maintenance, a janitor cleaning as we were being toured through the facility. And the CEO of this company greeted the janitor and talked to him a little bit and turned to me and said, you know, he's one of the more vital cog in the success of this company. And if he doesn't keep, and his team does not keep this place spick and span, we will not pass food health inspection and we'd be out of business. So we depend on him. And you can see the man was prideful of his job. So everybody has a value. And that would really struck with me. We talked about that man was doing his job, and he was key to it. So he was dedicated to his vocation, his job.
We're talking to Bill Stavropoulos. And in 2006, he founded the Michigan Baseball Foundation. When we come back, we're going to talk about that in regard to giving back. And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasul. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Bill Stavropoulos, who since 2006 has been the founder and president of the Great Lakes Loons, L-O-O-N-S, baseball team. Bill, you founded in 2006 the Foundation of Baseball in Mid-Michigan. Why?
Well, you know, the fourth commitment of life, I think, to a successful, happy life is giving back. And when I retired in 2006, I was wondering, what could we give back to the community that would be permanent, that would improve the quality of life in Midland and the Great Lakes Bay region? We came upon the idea of baseball, minor league baseball. And we also, we wanted it to be a social entrepreneurship. We wanted to run a successful business that would throw off cash that we could give back to the community in terms of charitable giving for youth activities, and that we could reinvest in further development in the community. You know, a lot of downtowns had deteriorated over the years, and Midland was no exception. So we thought that maybe putting a baseball park down here and bring a minor league team would help spark that development and revitalize downtown. So through the generosity of many foundations and individuals and the Dow Chemical Company, we built a first-class stadium and bought a minor league team, single-A team, which is now a Dodger, Los Angeles Dodger affiliate. And we put it right next to downtown, off Main Street, actually.
It's called Dow Diamond. You're being a little humble. You raised $38 million. It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, the Great Lakes Loons, as you mentioned, the L.A. Dodgers Class A team. You play from April through September, just like the pros.
Right.
Do you ever take batting practice?
I did about 6 or 7 years ago, and I gave it up.
Describe the Dodgers culture.
That's a great question. It is a culture of success. It's a culture that really cares about its people. Let me just give you one small example, Zach. Young men don't have the best diets, and they have very, minor league baseball players are riding buses, and their odd hours are out late at night. The game's over at 11 o'clock. They grab snacks and food, and they probably don't eat the best quality meals. So what the Dodgers have done now, they have a trailer with a kitchen, have a chef, and he's parked out behind the ballpark, and he cooks all the meals for the players. They care about their people. They teach them manners. They teach them not only baseball, but how to be a successful person. They're looking at the whole person. And, of course, they're very scientific in their training and their development. So they look at all aspects of a baseball player and an athlete to get the most out of them and so they can get the most out of their abilities. And it's a formula that really works. They have people, our manager, John Shoemaker, has been with the Dodgers for 50 years. He's a wonderful man. Tommy Lasorda has been with the Dodgers over 65 years. Vin Scully, who just retired, was one of the greatest announcers of all time, was the Dodgers for 62 years, I believe. So those are the sort of things that people, they care about their people, they grow their own, and they're driven by success. And giving back to the community, I would say, is what I would describe a Dodger.
Since 1979, Bill, 40 years, every year the National League has a Rookie of the Year as well as American League.
Mm-hmm.
But 11 of the last 40 Rookies of the Year have been Dodgers, including 2016 Corey Seager, 2017 the Cody Bellinger.
Who played here in Midland, Michigan.
Maybe the most unbelievable one. Clayton Kershaw. Tell us a Clayton Kershaw story, please.
Yeah. Clayton, when he came right out of high school, came here. And as soon as you saw him, Jack, you knew there was something different about that young man. He had the poise of a veteran. He had the fastball of a veteran. He had control of a veteran. And he conducted himself superbly. I remember talking to the farm director at the time about July of that rookie year when he was with the Loons and saying, this young man could be in the major leagues in 1 year. I go, he's 19 years old. I mean, you really believe that? He goes, yep. And sure enough, in August of that following year, he was a Dodger. And, of course, you've seen his career just blossom since then. But he was different. So is Corey Seager, and there's a handful of people who you can really see a difference with.
Clayton Kershaw grew up in Dallas, and in high school he was a center of a football team, and the kid he snapped the ball to was Matthew Stafford.
Yes, sir, the quarterback of the Detroit Lions, and they have a nice friendly rivalry and a great friendship.
Okay.
Clayton always said that he should have been the quarterback. He's got a better arm.
Yeah, but the way that Stafford's been hit so many times these last 10 years. What have these young ball players taught you and Linda?
That's a good question. I would say dedication, optimism, enthusiasm, and baseball is a grind. That's a long season. You're playing every single day. And you have to perform and you have to train. That stick-to-itiveness, it's inspiring to see them play with joy and try to reach their goals. A lot of them are not going to make it, But boy, they're all out there trying hard. And that's, to me, an example to everyone.
You talked about giving back to community. The Stavropoulos Family Foundation has made a huge gift to Notre Dame. Why so?
I got acquainted through Notre Dame through my son who graduated there, and my daughter got a master's degree after she graduated from Vanderbilt, and she married a Notre Damer. I got to know the university quite well through that and served on their science advisory board. And I was just struck with their mission, their values, what they want from their kids, how they run their university. They blend academia with athletics, with the arts, and above all, with integrity and trying to make the whole person. We love that philosophy, Linda and I, and we just wanted to be part of it. And we were just so pleased that we were in position to give back to Notre Dame. Because I think they provide so much for this country. They're a great example.
The campus is unbelievable. They take 2,000 kids a year. And they say, Bill, that you don't graduate from Notre Dame. You become a Domer. You become Notre Dame. Why?
I think that's well put, Jack. Well put. Our granddaughter is going to be going there in August, so we're looking forward to that.
If you were to talk to your granddaughter or any young listener tonight, as our time winds down, what advice would you give to the young listeners this evening?
Every single day, try to do the best you can. Long-range plans are good, but it's hard to plan your life. Just concentrate on what you're doing today and do it well. And then care for each other and care for your family, and you're going to have a good life.
Bill Stavropoulos, you are a modern-day Horatio Alger Store. Keep it up.
Thank you, Jack.
Please join us next Saturday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spohol.
Believe in yourself.